On your seats, you will have found a little bit of paper. We're going to be using the first half, headed The Church as a Worshipping Community. The back is for the workshop session following, which will last about an hour. And I have simply prepared four questions. I suggest that you don't look at them just now, but just before we break for tea, we ought to have a wee look to decide how you'd like to do the workshop sessions, because it could be done very strictly A, B, C, D, or you could get a choice. You can really see what you want to do. What I'm going to do now is a bit of scene setting. Well, this. Okay, if everyone's happy with that. Do a bit of scene setting, then a wee Bible tour and some applications. Now, Karl Barth famously said that the music of Mozart was the most theologically pure music ever written. But he lived when Europe was still center stage of the Christian world, and before the post-war sociological revolution, which has led to a real smorgasbord of worship styles. Now, I think it's true that the church in Scotland is no longer in captivity to a single culture, but nevertheless, its worship is inevitably influenced by a number of cultures, some of them in the past. So, let me begin by listing just a wee selection of cultures which appear in worship today, and I hope I'm using the word tolerably in line with what Jason explained to us yesterday, but sometimes in a slightly narrower sense. You may think of other cultures that influence our worship, but just to make it a bit more interesting at this stage of the day, I'll invite you to sing some illustrations along with me if you know the songs, and I'm going to keep it brief. Haven't got a keyboard, so we'll start with Protestant hymn culture, and I'm going to ask you to sing Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken, one verse, and we'll remain seated. Glorious things of Thee are spoken, Zion, city of our God. He whose word cannot be broken, from Thee for His own abode. On the rock of ages founded, what can shake Thy sure repose? With salvation's walls surrounded, Thou mayest smile at all Thy foes.
It's a Lutheran hymn tune.
It's normally accompanied by organ or piano. It's sung by the whole congregation. And that sort of tradition really has a view that the whole congregation is equal, singing praise to God with Christ as the true leader of our worship in heaven. It uses the language of Zion, very literally in that case. This style of worship, perhaps hymns and prayers, which are deeply influenced by Scripture, albeit usually an older version, such as the King James Version, or the equivalent in other languages. Now, the second major culture which influences our worship today is what I've called, very glibly, the worship song culture. So let's do number two, which is As the Deer Pants for the Water, and again we can remain seated.
As the deer pants for the water, so my soul longs after You. You alone are my heart's desire, and I long to worship You. You alone are my strength, my shield. To You
Now, within that culture, there are, of course, all kinds of subgroups, raising, I suppose, from songs from the 1970s charismatic revival movement, which are probably the kind that most of us are more familiar with, to Hillsong music and such like, which you will be relieved to know that I personally find outlandish, but nevertheless are very popular with a lot of younger people. Now, typically, songs like this are led with a band. If you noticed, the first song stood very well unaccompanied. You sang as a Deer Pants, which is one of the stronger, more melodic songs of that particular culture. But even so, we missed a little bit, a nice sort of piano or flute or something else, you know. So that these songs are typically led by a band rather than a professional organist, although a committed organist can actually do wonders with these songs, and organists shouldn't be so sniffy about them. Now, it shows a view of worship which makes room for people to use their different gifts, probably without being paid. It represents perhaps the serving gift in the list of natural gifts in Romans 12. But also, as that song illustrated, it's very typically about me and God. Now, it raises, obviously, questions of theology and balance, raises the question of excellence. Most of us would probably go along with the motto, or the older motto, of the Music and Worship Foundation, which is worship with skillful hands and integrity of heart. But we might also have a theological view of the church as a community where the poor are welcome, where children are to be encouraged, and hence you might have a very simple band, where worship is not to be treated as a performance. We might also understand the church as a loving community in such a way that the singing of an aged choir should be tolerated. However, I don't say that should happen automatically at all. It should be a very conscious decision if that's what you want to do. It raises the question of training of different people who may be leading worship, who haven't been to a college or been through a more formal training scheme. Raises questions of understanding the worship space, acoustics, all sorts of things like that. But most important, it raises the question of power. Charles Wesley knew how important it was to be in charge of the songs of the church. Now, often, the band leader chooses the songs. Are they just his or her favourites? Are they chosen to fit the theme of the sermon? Are they inclusive? But again, when you think of it, is that really any different from the power that most ministers have to choose the praise items? Well, it might be different in that many churches have a theology of ordination or commissioning. Even the Brethren do, because worship is in practice in Brethren assemblies largely led and certainly policed by their elders. Folk like ministers and perhaps elders are authorised by a congregation to lead their worship. The point is that most band leaders are not so authorised, and in my view, it would be theologically correct to commission them in some way, perhaps like those who teach the young at the start of a church year. And if you start commissioning people, that immediately raises questions for the congregation. Can we own these people? Are they trained? It raises some very healthy questions. Now, another culture, which is fairly influential in some sections of the Christian church, is what I call world church music culture. Now, originally, the main influences in sort of bringing this to the attention of churches in Scotland would be returning missionaries, people like Howard coming from Malawi and so on. But latterly, the person most associated with this is, of course, John Bell. There is the Tazi community, and there's the influence of the Eastern Orthodox churches, which are very big in America. So, sing the easiest one to sing, probably the way we should do it. I'm afraid you'll have to stand for this. I'm going to sit. I'll start you off and I'll start playing after we've got started. So please stand. We are marching in the light of God.
We are marching in the light of God. We are marching in the light of God.
We are marching in the light of God. We are marching in the light of God.
sorry. Okay. Now, that is an example of how songs get tamed by the church. And we managed quite successfully to tame that song. Not least because you had a sort of rather non-professional drummer with you. But originally it was a freedom song, a song which was sung by people who believed you should combine worship and social action, sung by people risking imprisonment for their witness in a repressive culture. The closest it normally gets to action in our churches is that we sing it when the offering is brought forward. Now, it raises another cultural point. In most parts of Africa, people naturally sing in parts. Were you singing that in parts?
Yes,
a little bit. But you sang the first one even more in parts. So, well done. But if this had been early 19th century Scotland, then, albeit with tunes with a rather more sober rhythm, there would have been far, far more part singing than in the church today. Singing has almost disappeared from school culture in Scotland, although actually in the last 2 years it has gone back a little bit, and that's a good sign. But for many people, karaoke, a football match, is the closest many get to singing, and probably not in parts. Now, a very different example of picking things up from another culture and taming them would be the hymn, O Sacred Head Surrounded. Da dee 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 dee. And that's quite fast compared with some churches, how it's sung. Originally, it was a tune which went like this. And it was successfully tamed for use in worship. Now, another culture is what we rather misleadingly call youth culture. Actually, there's no such thing. There are dozens and dozens of subcultures, and people like me are usually 10 years out of date anyway. However, I thought just as one example of something different, which is not a song, I'd give you something that I wrote for a youth service a few years ago, which gets something doing, people doing something that anyone can do if they have a voice at all. And it also gives a nod to the rap culture. Now, you can accompany this in various ways. Here's a very simple way of doing it, which is probably you will put up with. Something like that. All right, can you do that between verses? Try it with me. Okay, and then we'll do it. A nod to the old Presbyterian tradition. We'll line this out, okay? I'll do the first line, and you'll do the second one. That's not quite how they did it, Fergus, I know, but never mind. All right, war is hot and peace is cool. Watch your words and hold your tongue.
Don't be nasty, don't get stung.
Feelings come and feelings go.
You don't have to let them show.
Learn the time to let them fly.
Hit the air and not that guy.
War is hot and peace is cool.
Peace is better, that's the rule.
Jesus on the cross made peace.
From our fighting one release.
Keep your temper, grin and bear it.
Don't you tear it, no, repair it.
Say you're sorry, make amends.
That's the way to keep your friends.
Okay, and there's actually lots of ways of accompanying that, which, you know, are a lot better and more with it than that. Now, I'm personally very keen on stuff which crosses cultures. You can do that with a rap, if you've got a good jazz pianist who can play some chords as people are perhaps reciting a liturgy like that. Or, instead of the clapping, you could get a group of girls, or boys sometimes, but don't mix them for this, for dance, to do an active dance routine between verses, which would, of course, need to be rehearsed beforehand a bit. Now, finally, just for our sort of scene setting, there is what is often called alternative worship culture. But again, it's extremely varied. It started from perhaps the liberal wing of the church, but actually it's used much more widely than that now. And that makes use of the silence, of the arts, of movement, discussion, often use images on a screen. And I'm very grateful to Fergus for bringing a data projector with me, but I didn't bring my computer. So I want you just to imagine some images on the screen, because all of you will have seen this often. This is actually now so common in worship, I would say it's become almost mainstream. But when slides are used as a focus for prayer, it's generally for confession, intercession, or thanksgiving. And that's actually very useful, because if you introduce that sort of into a typical sort of what I called, I can't remember what I call it, pop culture or whatever, it's a refreshing change from the sometimes banal praise-only theme of such worship. You can get this sort of thing now done very professionally on DVD, although it usually comes with a particular style of music. And that, more than anything else, fixes the culture. And that's why I personally prefer using slides without music. Now, all that was really scene setting, just to sort of get us into this whole thing of worship. So let's do some Bible study. And we're going to do a very quick tour, first of the Old Testament, especially Genesis, which is really quite fruitful for this subject of worship and culture. Could we have a reading of Genesis chapter 2 and verse 3, please?
God blessed the seventh day and set it apart as a special day, because by that day he had completed his creation and stopped working.
Thanks. God blessed that day and made it special. Now, Jews and Christians vary in which feast days to keep special. In Scotland, there was a period when Christmas was not even celebrated at all. But we all recognise that the congregation should try to gather once a week for worship. Although when I say we all recognise, just as in early church cultures and in some very repressive cultures today, there is now a recognition that Sunday may not in fact be the best day for worship. So there are lots of experiments happening in this context. However, by implication, at the start of the Bible, our worship is set in the context of the whole of creation. So that, I think, is the wide cultural context for our worship and for all worship, whether or not we restrict it to one day a week or whatever. Can we have the next one, please? Genesis 4, 1-7.
Then Adam had intercourse.
Hang on.
Sorry.
Somebody has got this highlight. Yes.
Then Adam had intercourse with his wife, and she became pregnant. She bore a son and named him Cain. Later she gave birth to another son, Abel. Abel became a shepherd, but Cain was a farmer. After some time, Cain brought some of his harvest and gave it as an offering to the Lord. Then Abel brought the first lamb born to one of his sheep, killed it, and gave the best parts of it as an offering. The Lord was pleased with Abel and his offering, but he rejected Cain and his offering. Cain became furious, and he scowled in anger. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why that scowl on your face? If you had done the right thing, you would be smiling. But because you have done evil, sin is crouching at your door. It wants to rule you, but you must overcome it."
The story of Cain and Abel and their two offerings introduces the idea that worship needs an offering and that not all offerings of worship are acceptable. There are two cultures involved, what we might call cereal farming and animal farming, and you might think from the story that this is an early version of not so much the worship wars as the farming v fishing wars in the northeast of Scotland. Farmers traditionally Church of Scotland, fishers traditionally Brethren. However, the conversation between God and Cain about his anger does make it clear, I think, that God does not approve one culture rather than another. Rather, this story teaches us that worship is a matter of the heart, and that in turn has two consequences. First of all, you give to God the best of what you have, and second, you don't separate your worship from obedience of heart and life. Genesis chapter 8, 20-21, please.
Noah built an altar to the Lord. He took one of each kind of ritually clean animal and bird and burnt them whole as a sacrifice on the altar. The odour of the sacrifice pleased the Lord, and he said to himself, "Never again will I put the earth under a curse because of what man does. I know that from the time he is young, his thoughts are evil."
two different ideas introduced here. First, God has provided the material for Noah's sacrifice. These birds and animals were kept alive with Noah during the flood. And the second idea is, if worship pleases God, then he is going to be more patient with the sin that spoils every culture. And the next chapter introduces the idea of covenant with the rainbow as a sign, although it's not until Abraham that the idea of covenant is explicitly linked to worship. So let's have Genesis 14, 18 to 20 now.
And Melchizedek, who was king of Salem and also a priest of the Most High God, brought bread and wine to Abram, blessed him and said, "May the Most High God, who made heaven and earth, bless Abram. May the Most High God, who gave you victory over your enemies, be praised."
Now, as Christians, we read this in the light of our communion service and as a foreshadowing of Christ, our High Priest. But in the first place, it's about linking the blessing of a person with the praise of God. And this blessing is not just a vague kind of God bless you spiritually. It's a blessing of Abraham, who has fought a just war which God has commended. And the blessing is linked immediately to his culture. Now, if we followed this today, when we hold special services linked with specific cultures, I mean, let's pick biking as one such culture, okay? We would then end with a blessing such as, "May the God of skill and metal bless your bikes. May the God of speed bless your adrenaline and keep you safe. May the God of heaven bless your journeys and grant you a safe homecoming." And now Genesis 15. I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but this familiar chapter commends Abraham's faith. It commands a sacrifice, and it introduces a new covenant, an unconditional covenant to give Abraham and his descendants the land of Israel. Now, Christians are united in seeing worship linked to God's unconditional promise of blessing, although we have different views on how this might apply to Israel today. What is clear, however, is that the history of Israel and its worship is important, and that for every culture, the Old Testament has got much to teach us. And that's why I'm giving you, in fact, I think probably more points from the Old Testament than the New Testament on culture and worship. Now, my last illustration from Genesis is in chapter 22, and that's the story of how Abraham was tested by God with the command to sacrifice his son Isaac, the child of promise. Now, Jews generally interpret this as a clear signal from God that Abraham's worship must be different from the worship of the surrounding nations who sacrificed their children to God. There we have the scene. Abraham is going to sacrifice his child, and God says, "No, you're not going to do it." Christians generally focus on Abraham's sacrificial commitment to God and on the substitution of the ram, with the Lord providing the sacrifice. For our purpose, let's take this anyway as a signal that our worship is to be distinct. Now, while it may be appropriate and a mission opportunity to hold special services, as with the bikers I mentioned, our worship must not unthinkingly take anything and everything from the culture around us. Finally, two other key Old Testament references. Exodus 12, I really have to mention, because that's the Passover ritual. It's enormously important for Jews, whose whole culture is deeply marked by this. The main influence on Christians from the Jewish tradition is the setting in families, tradition of family worship, and the idea that when the church gathers around the Lord's table, this is a family celebration and memorial. Now, there's a huge lot more in the rest of the Pentateuch, but in the main, we would see what is said as prefiguring the sacrifice of Christ and not culture-specific for us. But there is one more reading that we must look at as really a deep warning. That's from Amos chapter 5, please.
"The Lord says, 'I hate your religious festivals. I cannot stand—'"
Hang on, Howard. I'm going to be very rude. Sorry. I realise because... Now, I
didn't understand. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry about that. But yeah, we have actually got somebody else to read that. So, as you've had a go at the first one, I think
yes,
we
I
have
did.
This Is that your one?
No, I read Genesis 14, 18 to 20.
All right, in that case, I will apologise. Howard, let us have this one, please. Okay. Thank you.
The Lord says, I hate your religious festivals, I cannot stand them. When you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. I will not accept the animals you have fattened to bring me as offerings. Stop your noisy songs, I do not want to listen to your harps. Instead, let justice flow down like a stream and righteousness like a river that never goes dry. Mm.
And Micah chapter 6 is even more pointed, teaching that you can embrace culture in your worship to the extent of sacrificing your firstborn child, but God asks us to critique a culture like that, as he hates it. Just one quite trivial application of this. A lot of the music in our culture is actually damaging for the ears, and it is not right to have a level of volume of music in worship that is damaging to the ears. Just a sort of trivial illustration of critiquing a culture. Another quick tour through the New Testament. And actually, there's little directly about worship in the Gospels. We rather assume that Jesus and his friends attended the synagogue. We know that Jesus was himself worshipped, particularly as a baby and as a risen Lord. And we know that the early church was quite consistent in regarding Jesus as God and therefore to be worshipped. And I suppose that we would thank Larry Hurtado in particular for the work that he has done more recently on this, as well as Howard Marshall earlier on. Secondly, we also know that worship became detached from the synagogue with its specific Jewish culture. It took different forms. I mean, contrast the somewhat freewheeling worship of 1 Corinthians 14 with the much more prescribed pattern of 1 Timothy 2. But clearly, the New Testament is concerned primarily with doctrine and life, not worship practice. Once the Gentiles are fully part of the church, as was decided in Acts 15, the Council of Jerusalem, they are not to be troubled with Jewish culture, with the critical addendum that love and the need for harmony must limit cultural freedom. Although the context of that, the context for the necessary rules that they had to follow, is life together rather than worship. Now here's a third point. Paul is aware that God still has a purpose for the nation of Israel, although Christians don't agree just how to understand this. In Romans 9:4, he says of his own Jewish people, they have the true worship. Interesting. And I think this text justifies the interest that Christians take in Jewish culture and practice and such events, for example, as holding a Christian Passover. However, Paul also, in Romans 12, asks us to consider ourselves as a living sacrifice and says that this is the true worship. Fourth point from the New Testament. You might think that Hebrews would be the place par excellence where the New Testament teaches us how to worship. But after showing how Christ is the true leader of our worship as our high priest, the writer simply says in Hebrews 12:28, let us worship God in a way that will please him with reverence and awe. Again, something that must apply in every culture. Final point from the New Testament. The New Testament book which says most about worship is, of course, Revelation. Heaven is full of worship, and heavenly worship is the destiny of the saints. Moreover, all the nations will come and worship God. That's in chapter 15, which means that at the very least, out of every human culture, people will be worshipping God. And Revelation 7:9 speaks specifically of every tribe and language. So, after that wee tour, I hope you're not too breathless, but here are some conclusions. Because I'd like to suggest how some of this biblical teaching might apply to our worship in Scotland today. And again, I'm taking this along the line of this conference being about the church and culture. One, we should in some way in our worship reflect the variety of culture in Scotland today. Not all culture. There is a cult of personality, which I think we should resist, And, for example, we should take great care before we expose young Christians, who may be celebrities, to the dangers of giving testimony. However, our songs, our prayers, our preaching should relate to our human cultures. I fully take the point that Jason Curtis made yesterday, that willy-nilly our worship is enculturated. However, I think we need to do it consciously and conscientiously, so that it relates to culture today and not yesterday, and therefore to the whole variety of cultures which make up together what we might call culture. Now, we probably can't do this all the time. We can't do it in any one act of worship, but certainly at many times and in a variety of ways we should be doing this. Why? Here are two reasons. Firstly, Jesus Christ is Lord of every culture. In heaven, he is already worshipped by those of all cultures, and so we seek this to be true on earth, at least in some degree. Now, there might have been a time in Scotland where you could say, oh, well, we'll worship God in our way, and the Japanese Christians can worship, if there are any, you know, in their way. But life is no longer like that. We have every culture here. And we must in some way, some appropriate way, reflect that. Secondly, we have so much to learn from other cultures. It's a commonplace to say that we gave the world European hymns and now Africans, Asians, and American Christians are returning the compliment. This is not simply a head thing. It would be a good thing to do, let's do it. I believe God intends this to be a heart thing also. I am deeply moved by our own Scottish culture, whether it is the rich music from centuries ago of Robert Carver or the simple folk songs used by John Bell and others. And I'm also deeply moved by music from the World Church. Now, some people may start, I think some people lead with their heads, other people lead with their hearts, and that's okay. But in the end, head and heart should be involved in both the leading and the response in worship. But this is not just a taste thing. God made us in his image, and he set his image in people of every culture. So when I experience the worship of other cultures, I understand a little more about God. I also understand a little more about the body of Christ, because that body is international. Now, here's a second shorter point. We should also take care to confront the evil in our culture and not sanitize our worship. Now, of course, we need a balance. The primary task of worship is to celebrate the goodness of God and to give thanks for what is good in the world he's made. I don't think that worship should simply wallow in the tragedies of the world. But neither should it be just an escape from a nasty world. People bring their hurts to worship. They're not just sinners, but people who are sinned against. And so we need laments as well as praise songs. We need to confess the sins of our generation as well as to give thanks. We need to pray for people in their Monday working lives. Now, third point. We should think very clearly about the relation between outreach and worship. Now, seeker-sensitive churches, so-called, try to have music which appeals to the lowest common denominator, typically perhaps Radio 2 music and nothing else. No hymns, except perhaps one or two really well-known tunes like Amazing Grace. We might think that popular culture is poor, even inauthentic, but like Paul, we can become all things to all so that by all means we might save some. That would be the approach. Now, someone like Bill Hybels is quite intentional about this. He holds worship for the believers midweek, and his Sunday event, called a seeker service, is more a gospel presentation than worship as such. I respect that approach, but it requires immense resources to do the outreach thing well. And most churches in Scotland are in a different league altogether. And for good or ill, they have their weekly worship as their shop window. Now, I want to suggest that this is not just a second best. Well, we haven't the resources to do it the American way. I want to suggest that this is actually a normal approach for the church, that the weekly worship should be our shop window, except in times of active persecution, say, when the church may be forced underground. Now, you may think that I'm simply following an Old Testament model or harking back to a supposedly, quote, Christian Scotland, unquote. No, what I'm saying, I believe, follows from the basic structure of worship. First, we gather in the presence of God. Then we hear what God may have to say to us. Then we consider our response. If we cannot invite an outsider to do these things, then it means we have grown an alien culture within our own congregations. As a minister, I lead worship for human beings, not for aliens, however spiritual some of this alien culture may seem to be. And this, I think, follows the pattern of our Lord's own ministry. The outsiders, the ordinary people, heard him, and some followed him and learned what a life of obedience and worship was all about. Many of the religious folk did not follow him. They preferred their own alien religious culture. I'm not at all saying that all worship must be a pop-style event. There is a difference between making people feel at home in worship and shortchanging them by dumbing down what we do. Now, the practical difficulty comes, of course, when regular worshippers enjoy, let's say, a choir singing a four-part anthem. There are a few of these left in Scotland. And an expository sermon lasting 40 minutes. Now, I personally like both of these, but I've departed from this as a matter of course for several reasons. Here are two. Firstly, and this you may think is controversial, I no longer think that the sermon should be the high focus of worship. I do believe in preaching from the whole of Scripture. I love going through a biblical book, but worship has other high points in it. Now, although I base this change I have come to on the general teaching of Scripture, it did come to my attention very vividly many years ago when I conducted a survey of how people felt God spoke to them during the service. You know, I had one of these little forms, and I was expecting to have a bell curve, with nearly everybody finding the sermon was when God spoke to them. But not a bit of it. It was a blessing, was the majority one. That really made me think. Another thing is that musical tastes vary enormously. But it is a matter of horses for courses. Very few choirs nowadays can sing anthems decently, and they shouldn't try. It's far better to arrange simple songs in two or three parts and use the choir, if you have one, in partnership with the congregation. And also, talk to people about what they think would work and they would find helpful, rather than assuming that you, as a worship leader, know what's good for them. Worship is not an activity so fenced that it is only for those who can be proved to be saints. It's an open activity, in my view, and therefore it has an evangelistic edge willy-nilly. I can remember days when there was a clear distinction between the service for the saints and the service for the sinners. You know, morning communion, gospel meeting in some traditions. Now, this is perhaps not entirely past, but in my own experience, you get all sorts of people at public worship, so that worship should both relate to people in their own cultures and be an offering to God reflecting the cultures present. Now, of course, you might think, oh, it's a Church of Scotland thing because we do public worship, quote unquote. But the question I'm raising is not just about some legal requirement for Church of Scotland services, but really the suggestion that all worship ought to be public. Now, yes, I think I'll leave out a page. I've got a bit of theology on incarnation and atonement sort of backing up some of this stuff, but let me just give you a pointed summary to finish, and then we can have some discussion. One, we go wrong if we put up with worship, which is boring anyway, and then think, let's change our worship so we can get outsiders in. If the insiders are not inspired with what is happening, we've already lost it. Two, we go wrong if we think that normal worship includes preaching, which demands a lifetime of study and the concentration span of an ox, or if we use hymns with language which is centuries old. I personally like that sort of preaching and those sort of hymns, but God may find them rather boring. Three, we go wrong if we think that punters will be attracted by so-called Christian songs which have banal lyrics. If a congregation sings them with enthusiasm and doesn't repeat them too often, they may make some kind of impression, but generally they are songs for the converted of a particular ethos. Four, we go wrong if we turn worship into a circus with the minister or somebody else as compere. Now, while there are songs which are directed as one another, as well as songs which are directed to God, and some psalms mix the two, worship in general is for God. And we base what we do on the belief that every human being is made for worship. Even though sin gets in the way, worship is for sinners. I believe that worship, culture, and evangelism belong together, because it is in Jesus Christ that all things hold together. He embraced our culture in order to lead us to God. His risen life and prayer is the true worship. And we share that as encultured men and women and young people in his spirit. So, does worship matter? Of course. It matters to God since it is his right. He alone deserves our worship. It matters to those who love him. It's our duty and our delight. And it renews our lives. And it matters to the world. Not only is it a witness that some human beings choose not to ignore God, it's the place and time when we express the worship of a creation which is dumb without us. Thank you. Now, that's left us with 10 minutes. So,
any questions? Comments?
I mean, you may prefer simply to sort of handle discussion and questions in the workshop, and that's fine if that's what you want to do. But this is your chance to disagree personally and pointedly with me.
Could you unpack a bit more what you said about... did you say the sermon is not the highlight or not the only highlight? I'm not sure. Could you unpack?
Yeah. Yes, let me... it's not the focus. It's one of the focuses. I mean, why do I say that? I think because of an understanding of what worship is, that worship is coming to God and responding to God as well as listening to God. It is a natural focus, and it often becomes that, but I don't think it should be the focus. And I think that the habit of some people, and I mean, you know, I count myself in this group. You go along to a church, why do you go, well, so-and-so is preaching, and yes, you know, it's the whole sort of mindset is it's about preaching. I just have to say this, I think this is wrong. It's not what worship is about in Scripture. You know?
Yeah, but worship, our worship is a response. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that our tradition of foregrounding the sermon, if you like, is, I think, to highlight that. Now, I'm not suggesting, you know, that 40-minute sermons are the ideal at all.
But I mean, by saying foregrounding and then backgrounding, if you like, that's in a sense giving it away almost. You know, is our... I mean, one of the good things, I'm not actually very keen on this idea that, you know, in some churches you have, let's have some worship, so you have all the songs, and then what happens afterwards? Is it not worship? That's the other extreme. But nevertheless, there is a point in saying that when we bring our praise and our prayers to God, this is a high point of worship. It is not just preparing for the sermon. That's all. Yeah. So I'm not wanting to fall out.
No, we're not falling out at all, John. Yeah. I agree with you, because traditionally we've spoken about the rest of the service, broadcast before the sermon, as the preliminaries.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, wrong.
Yeah, that's a good point to make.
Could I ask a supplementary question? And that is the importance of the public reading of Scripture, which you didn't mention.
Yes, I think that is important. Yeah. I was very moved. I go to one of these, I now go to one of these rather sort of traditional church, cathedral type churches, and I'm finding it a lot better than I had expected. And one of the high points is they have elders who read wonderfully. And one of the elders just said to me last Sunday, after he'd read, he had a long pause before he read. And, you know, he then explained to me afterwards why he had paused, because there had been a slight mistake in the actual numbering of the verses he was supposed to read, and he realised he had to read beforehand to understand what he was going to read. And he just stood there, he read it, he understood, oh, now I can read this. And he read it very, very well. I was most impressed with that, and I think it is an important part of worship. Yes, Stephen.
Touched on but didn't really elaborate the sort of difference in content between the more traditional say Church of Scotland hymn book, where you would go through, I'm not sure how many sections there are, but it looks at least about eight to my remembrance, and then you sort of get to a lot of these modern hymns, which are modern songs, where, as you say, it only seems to be, you know, between me and God, you know. Can you sort of elaborate any more on that?
Well, are you familiar with the New Church Scotland hymn book?
Not so much.
Because I think it's very good. It has, in fact, integrated. It still has the psalms at the beginning. But other than that, it has actually integrated them in themes, I think, very well. So it's not sort of, here are the solid hymns, here are a few choruses. It's not like that at all. It's all integrated. Although there is a section at the end for some short songs and amens and things like that. But I think they've made very good sense of looking at what is the purpose of this particular song. And again, some of the shorter songs are sung very helpfully as responses, or linked together in a particular way, or there are some choruses which are linked beautifully. Going back in my personal experience, this was brought to my attention when I went to church at, do you know Alvey in Speyside? Mm-hmm. Worship was being led by the president of the Women's Guild, who traditionally would be rather, she had a guitar. She was leading worship very well. And this is many years ago. And she put together two songs which illustrate the way of, I think, putting together things at its best. I should try the keyboard for this, but it was the song, "Who is he in yonder stall, at whose feet the shepherds fall? 'Tis the Lord, O wondrous story, 'tis the Lord, O King of glory. At his feet we humbly fall. Crown him, Lord of all. Pom, 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 majesty." Beautifully put together, both melodically and also in terms of the theme. And that way, you know, if people had done that, there would be no controversy in the church about these awful choruses. You know, it's a question of being trained well and having the imagination to use resources well. A lot of controversy in the church comes just because we do things so badly.
Where would you recommend that Christian, mostly but not exclusively, young people who often quote unquote lead worship or lead the music, where will they get training? Because they're often hugely enthusiastic, and we talk about them needing training, but do you know of anywhere where they can get it?
We used to run courses at Calvary for this.
Yes.
But Music and Worship Foundation does some of these things.
The Methodist Church has a worship leader's course.
Sorry?
The Methodist Church has a short worship leader's course.
Yeah. Church of Scotland also has, usually done on a presbytery basis, courses for those leading worship. But part of it, young people sort of they don't go within a mile of these things because they assume they will be fuddy-duddy and whatever. So, I mean, there is a real problem in communicating. What is most effective, actually, and occasionally I've done this, and it doesn't have to be me, it could be somebody else, is if you have a group who are leading worship, do something in situ and then tell the assemblies and congregations round about you're doing it. And that way you've got enough to make something go and other people can feed into it. So that's really a thing to do. If there's a congregation where this is a problem, then get the young people themselves to buy into it so that someone comes into that congregation rather than... Because if you send people away, you'll be lucky to get more than perhaps one or two going. So that would be my suggestion. Organise something right on the spot. And the importance of getting, first of all, a number is that then that's reinforcement afterwards. If one person goes away, they come back and it doesn't work very well. And also you can get one or two older people involved as well, so that then the whole congregation has a sort of investment in this. I think often in our training, we're always, ministers are very bad at this, we're content focused. Or we think if there's a good theological reason for this, then everyone will buy into it. We have to be much more, as you were saying yesterday, relationship focused. How is this going to help relationships in our congregation? Who are the key people who need to be doing this together so that in learning together they will build a new relationship and that will bless the congregation? These are very important questions, I think.
Do you have a view on a blended service where you try and use a variety of different types and styles of music?
Yeah, I mean,
splitting between two services that some congregations are doing into contemporary and traditional.
Yes, we have faced this. We ended up with two services in our congregation, but I think blended worship is excellent. It needs to be done well, but I regard this as a very good thing to aim at. Yes. But, as I say, again, training, I think, is very helpful because most ministers are very bad at this, can't cope with it. They just, let alone, you know, anyone else. Yes. Yeah. And I would say that good worship of this kind is more, not less demanding. Mm. Yeah. Mm. But why should it be the minister? In some way, I buy strongly into the idea that actually you should get other people to lead the worship. It's a great idea, provided they can do it well, and provided it's part of the sort of recognition by the congregation. These are gifts that the Lord has given, and we affirm these gifts.
I think they're also, Jock, I never quite got the balance right here, but the business of training on the job seems to me to be significantly important. Now, that means that sometimes when people are buying into it, as it were, the quality of worship may not be just the kind of quality you would really want, but unless that's encouraged, it seems to me you'll never get to the kind of quality that you do want involving the gifts of all the people. I think the other thing that I found in my experience is the use of language. I just stopped using the word hymn and chorus. Mm-hmm. You know, I would have folks, you know, we'll start now singing the chorus, From Heaven He Came. You know, which is a classic hymn, if in the old kind of style in some ways.
Yeah.
But just use the words, even using the word song.
Mm.
And I think that helps, I think, to get round this issue of the kind of inclusive worship, you know, the different styles in the one service.
No, those are two very good points, thank you.
Any comments on the phenomenon of the worship leader, who seems to have a kind of status in many churches?
In our tradition, the precentor was the Presbyterian tradition, was the precentor. The Roman Catholic Church uses a word which is from the same root, cantor. And I think worship leader, the trouble is, it appears to be pretentious. But I mean, I think it's fine. As I was saying, I think that provided a worship leader can be recognized, trained as Christian maturity, and operates as a very close team with the minister of it is or whoever, that's fine. I think it's also important to distinguish between leading worship and accompanying worship. I mean, organists generally accompany worship, whereas a band It's an open question. They usually lead worship, but it's worth thinking exactly what you're going, what you're doing, and why. And these are questions which bands actually need to wrestle with. And I mean, one of the things that I've tried to do in the past is sort of training for bands. I have to say, Rose, coming back to your point, there is some wonderful stuff from the London School of Theology. They have an excellent course every summer, which is absolutely superb, and I really recommend that. I have to confess that although I've tried to sort of bring bits of that into Scotland, it's, you know, they're just excellent. Do you want to unpack what's behind what you're saying a bit more?
The worship leader, not so much as a presenter or a cantor, but they kind of thread everything together. You know, that's their kind of... Some have a gift for doing that.
I think if someone is gifted for that, it's great. If you can have a humble servant of the congregation who does that. As long as it... I mentioned the danger of the minister or the worship leader becoming a compere. I think there's a word which is used often for worship that flows. Now, I have experienced worship which absolutely flowed. There's some worship which is quote-unquote charismatic. But it's a special gift from God. It doesn't often happen. And the trouble is the churches which sort of expect that sort of worship often fall into awful traps, and it's rubbish. But if worship can flow without being led all the time, it's a great gift. And sometimes that's where really good musicians can be very helpful, if they're open to what is happening and can pick up something. I mean, for example, I have never, I'm afraid, had, except at Carberry, we sometimes managed to do this, because we have some very good visiting musicians. In our congregation, we didn't have musicians who were sort of gifted musically and spiritually for this. But what I would really like as a preacher is to preach, and then somebody else should pick up the response with the congregation. Sometimes that can be musical, sometimes in other ways. But that's what I would really like as a preacher.
A good organist will do that.
He can, but only, if you like, if the scope of possible response is here, the organist is just this. You're absolutely right. It's very good if you can do it well, but there's a whole lot of other things which an organist couldn't do.
Is there any value in spontaneity in any parts
of... I love spontaneity, but, I mean, it's a risky strategy. I've been in congregations where there's been plenty of spontaneity, and you thought, oh dear. Other times when, wow, this is the Lord. How many know we're fallen human beings? And I think it's... sometimes in my own ministry, we've had what I've called an open spot. So there's been a structure about it. This is an open spot, and sometimes it works brilliantly, sometimes it doesn't. That way, you're not sort of caught in you're trying something and it's got to do a certain thing, or if it doesn't happen, it's a disaster. You know, I think having some place for spontaneity would be good, but it depends a bit the dynamics of the congregation, how far the congregation are ready for this. I mean, there's lots of things you have to take into account. What I think, and I say this as someone who's sometimes been too pushy, I think there's a big danger that a worship leader or a minister or whoever comes along and he or she thinks this is how we're going to do it, and they actually push what they want on a congregation. And that's not good.
You had a perhaps throwaway comment at one point where you talked about the importance of today's worship and not yesterday's. I have an Asian friend who's musically trained, who's moved to London and goes to an Anglican church, and when I asked her what was the music like there, she said they only seem to sing songs from the 1970s. And I wonder if one of the tensions in focusing too much on contemporary music without taking away from the need to sing a new song and be contemporary is that when we focus in on one musical style, that ends up being our only musical style. And in some ways, the use of the Genevan Psalter in Scotland represents a moment in history that has become ossified, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, isn't there a need within the confines of the musical literacy that is there, which is sometimes a bit limited, to try to introduce people to diversity of culture, but also diversity of history in music?
I mean, that's parallel to what... C.S. Lewis wrote an introduction to a translation of Athanasius's De Incarnatione, and in that introduction he said, it's very important, if we've got this right, unless I'm mixing up two things, I think it was that, he said that it's very important for Christians not to read just books from one culture and one period of history, because, you know, as we look back, we can see all the mistakes they made, but we don't see the mistakes that we're making. And so, yes, that sort of diversity is very good. But I think it has to be done probably with a bit of encouragement and explanation. You know, sometimes if I was singing a very old hymn, I would introduce it by saying, this is what they did for this reason. Otherwise, people think, oh, what's this? An old hymn, we don't know it, you know? So sometimes a wee bit of encouragement can be helpful. Give, what was it? Gear Scott, a theological explanation. There's Nathan Winnie Day for you. One of Walter Scott's characters, I think. One.